Singhu, Tikri. They built their own townships around Delhi and protested. You know, the enthusiasm it roused, 3,000 farmers went from Maharashtra to join them and opened their own camp at Shahjahanabad, the border of Rajasthan, Haryana. Shahjahanpur. So, on one occasion, when some of us went around the Singhu camp, and there was a little group there that did a survey, 21 languages were spoken in that camp, in Singhu. Of course, the maximum number were from Punjab and Haryana. They are approximately the closest states. Of course, they're going to be more from there than anywhere else. 2,000 came from Nashik, from just one union, the Kisan, All India Kisan Sabha. And you know what many of these volunteers from other states were doing? They were volunteering for kitchen duty. You can read all these stories in the one website that created a category just for protests, farmers' protests, People's Archive of Rural India. And you'll see little kids peeling peas in the Rajasthan cap, and little Fateh Singh, 3-year-old, peeling peas with his mom for the cooking in the Shahjahanpur camp. Not one newspaper, not one channel would even mention that the main slogans of the farmers were naming Mr. Ambani and the second richest Indian, Mr. Adani. You know, a lot of these Punjabis and farmers have a Fauji background. They conducted one operation and took out 150 cell towers of Ambani. That was reported in two paragraphs. It was a devastating blow to Jio. You know, incidentally, Mr. Ambani's Jio mobile service was personally advertised by the Prime Minister. We woke up one morning to find Prime Minister's photograph and the Jio ad in one frame on the front page of every newspaper. You know, in Indian law, that is illegal. There is a Emblems and Symbols Act under which you cannot use the photos of the Prime Minister, the President, the to advertise a product unless there is a prior permission from the highest levels. So I responded immediately saying, wonderful, now we can change the national exhortation from Jai Hind to Jio Hind.
Yeah. You're listening to P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. We're online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Why would they not say a single word about Ambani or Adani in the media? Because Mr. Ambani is the largest owner of corporate media, and that media he does not own, he's the largest advertiser. So you're not going to screw around with him. Nor are you going to screw around with the government advertising, because that is the only source for many hundreds of newspapers in India during the COVID-19 pandemic. And there was one moment of brilliance in the reporting of pandemic in October 2021, when people started reporting the bank of bodies piled up on the banks of Ganga, Sarayu, Satlej, etc. When that happened, suddenly cold turkey, it disappeared. It just disappeared. All the reporting disappeared, because the government pulled government advertising from all the publications. One newspaper group went ahead, called Dainik Bhaskar. They continued to report. They were 2 weeks into it. They were raided by every enforcement agency imaginable. So the Enforcement Directorate, the Intelligence Bureau, the Income Tax, the Police, the customs, the anybody who, GST guys, everybody was there. To their credit, Dainik Bhaskar went, they took a huge beating and then had to soften down. They had no choice. Ernst & Young calculated India's media entertainment industry value at $28 billion in March this year, out of which a gigantic share belonged to Mr. Ambani. Now, they're going about the listed companies when they're putting up these trades. A single transaction in April added 30% to the value when Mr. Ambani and Reliance, his company, initiated a merger with Disney Hotstar worth $8.5 billion, which gives them 60% of streaming in India. 60% of all streaming in India is now the property of Ambani Disney, which have merged. Now, when you made this added $8.5 billion, it meant that the value of the Indian media industry went to $36 billion, out of which 30-35% is owned by one individual. I don't know, we have to calculate. Mr. Ambani has more TV channels than he knows, than he can name. The media are all sewn up, except for the very combative, brave individual journalists. One of the things that was fantastic about the election coverage, where all the media got it wrong, you know who got it right? The cutting edge of Hindi journalism today is appearing in young YouTubers in Uttar Pradesh. No money, no resources, but they did it. And that is one of the they are the throwback to one of the finest traditions of Indian journalism. You fight regardless. Yeah? And they told the truth. They spoke the truth about power. They did not even speak to power. They spoke to people, they spoke the truth about power. Oh, by the way, here's a very funny thing. There's a gigantic Indian website at the cost of 110 crores, that's 1,110 million rupees, Azadi Ka Amrut Mahotsav, where there are no photos of freedom fighters who are alive, but there are 1,000 photos of you know who. The same photo that you get on every COVID vaccination certificate. The same photograph that very possibly soon might be on every bus ticket. Oh, another thing about corporate media, your corporate media in North America. The farmers' protests were also cut badly because Google, Facebook, Twitter, they have admitted as much through whistleblowers and through their own selves in the hearings in US Congress that the largest number of takedowns and suspensions of accounts or killing of accounts, the request came from the government of India under Mr. Narendra Modi. Elon Musk, of course, had to make a great drama of it about how he told the Indian government, this is a very wrong thing. You're harming freedom of expression. But we did it anyway. Because Facebook, for instance, I think the biggest share of revenue from any one country that it draws is India. It's about the money. It's about corporate media. In fact, would you believe it? After a young 18-year-old girl was arrested, Disha Ravi, for her environmentalism and activism, the Delhi police issued a tweet thanking Google and Twitter for helping them in the matter of tracing the toolkit. So then PARI, People's Archive, my website, started growing. It doubled. It trebled. It trebled in because we were covering the farmers' web. Incidentally, we published in 15 languages. So it was delightful to watch retired brigadier generals and retired colonels sitting in Singhu looking at PARI on their cell phones or actually even on laptops or tablets. You'll see we've done stories from the camps. Now, suddenly, our growth stopped. Cold turkey it fell. What had happened? The government of India, we know, got Google to tweak its algorithm ever so slightly so that searches for farmers' protests fell 60%. So guys, you see how many ways of gagging there are. And then the most important of all of them, big money inequality. In India, in 1991, we did not have a single dollar billionaire. Actually, it took 5-6 years in the new economic policies, in the neoliberal path, to produce our first billionaire. By 2019, we produced 98. That means we produce new billionaires at the rate of one every 70 days. Okay, 98 across 20. Every 70 days, we minted a new billionaire. We rank number 3 in the Forbes list. Even now, we rank number 3. There were some pretenders earlier, like Germany and Russia and all that. I mean, but who takes Russia seriously, right? Russians, damn it. Every 5 years, the Russians send half their billionaires to prison. We send ours to parliament. Mature democracy. Right? So we send ours to parliament. You can see them there. Jindal, the whole works. I mean, I can name 6 of them over there, over in parliament. So anyway, we got rid of all these pretenders. We still have a little matter of China to deal with. The 800-pound gorilla on the list is, of course, the United States. Then comes China, then comes us. The same country which ranks number 3 in the world in Forbes billionaires list ranks number 132 in the Human Development Index of the United Nations. Ranks 178 out of 180 nations in the Environmental Performance Index devised by Columbia and Yale. Ranks 159 in the World Press Freedom Index out of 180 nations. In the Environmental Performance Index in 22, until somebody botched it up really bad in another country, we actually managed to be 180 out of 180 in 2022. Since then, somebody did worse than us and allowed us to step up 2 notches in the ladder. We rank 111 out of 121 nations in the Global Hunger Index of IPRI. And this is at the same time that the Prime Minister is making speeches about how India, he's the Vishwa Guru, remember, right? I call him that. I always address him as the Vishwa Guru. It somehow seems appropriately obnoxious. The Vishwa Guru is telling the world that India will solve the problems of global nutrition security. India leads the world in stunting and wasting. Wasting is by, you know, weight to height. Stunting is height to age group. So that's the wonderful thing, that we are solving the problems of the world but can't seem to shake off these tags ourselves. So the big money inequality, let me show you the kind of inequality. This is on as of July 16, 2024. The cumulative wealth of India's $200 billionaires is $974 billion. The Indian budget expenditure for 2023-24 was 45,562 billion US dollars. That means the cumulative wealth of our billionaires is 1.7 times greater than the entire budget of 1.4 billion human beings. That is 1.7 times Indian budget's expenditure. But the cumulative wealth of 200 individuals is 62 times India's agricultural budget. Talk about farm distress now. 62 times India's agricultural budget, which is 15.62 billion US dollars. You know what 200 or 215 now it is, I think, yesterday? $215 billionaires. I said by 2019 we had accumulated 98. In the next 30 months, we crossed 200. You know when we added our highest number of dollar billionaires? First 12 months of COVID-19. And who were the largest group with the new billionaires? Pharma, health sector. Do you know that when I say Indian billionaires, what do you guys think? You think tech industry, high tech. They're number 3. Above them is manufacturing. Above manufacturing is healthcare sector. I never use that word. I call it health cash sector. It's a health cash sector. And they had in 2022 twice the number of dollar billionaires that India's wanted tech industry had. IT had 16, these guys had 22. India's estimated budget, I've already given you. Ambani's personal, one individual, his net worth, 118 billion USD, is 7.5 times the expenditure on agriculture as stated in the budget. one individual. Mind you, for his son's wedding, the Indian Air Force was deployed to take over air traffic control at Jamnagar Airport. And Jamnagar Airport, in 1 week, was declared as an international airport. You know where bloody Jamnagar is? Then, anyway, Mukesh Ambani's net worth is actually in rupees, it's 9.8 trillion Indian rupees. Now, you know, one of the things that I intended to do was to study the promise of capitalism. What does capitalism tell us, guys? It tells us that if you work as hard as Ambani, you can also do it. Now, I've had theoretical problems with that. So, well, the theoretical problem simply is, if hard work makes you a billionaire, every woman in rural India would be a billionaire. And every woman in rural Africa, rural Latin America would be a billionaire if hard work makes you a billionaire. But since they are not, you need to question the validity of that, of capitalism's great promise. You work hard, you'll also be a billionaire. I think I work terribly hard. I work 18 hours a day. And I'm nowhere near to being 1/10 of a millionaire. Anyway, never mind. Okay. So this kind of inequality feeds into all those other gaggings. By the way, do you know how many 200 billionaires are in a population of 1.4 billion? They are 0.00014% of the population, controlling a wealth equivalent between 1/4 and 1/5 of our gross domestic product. Bringing to your mind that whole other meaning of the word gross. Forget the economists. I found that the best description of the mindset of inequality came from a woman I understand who is paralyzed and laid up and is not active anymore, but her Instagram post explained inequality better than the mindset of inequality better than any philosopher or economist I know. And this is what she said. If a monkey hoarded more bananas than it could eat, while most other monkeys starved, scientists would study that monkey to figure out what the heck was wrong with it. When humans do it, we put them on the cover of Forbes. All these things feed back into the gagging. The wealth, the inequality. You know what? One of the common techniques, we have imported it from the United States, is the slap strategy. The legal strategy of, you guys know what the slap strategy is? Okay, you don't. Slap is strategic litigation against public participation. So I intimidate you by putting a $100 million legal suit against you. Just give you an example. Intercept, which has done some of the finest exposes of the New York Times and others when it comes to Gaza and Palestine. Intercept has twice been sued by billionaires. They've won the both cases and they are $500,000 poorer. In slap strategy, you win the case, you still lose the case. Because we are all small units, small outfits. My friend Paranjoy Guha Takurta has been hit for 100 crores, 50 crores by Ambani, by Adani, all of them. It paralyzes you. And all the time you're running from one court to another. So please, this is just the crudest level at which it feeds in. Then the same 200 guys own your media. They're able to do anything in the law courts. Can I go up against the highest paid lawyers in Asia? You can't. You don't have that capacity. You are gagging through law, gagging through outlaws and violence. You're gagging through corporate media. You're gagging through big money and inequality. And finally, the gagging comes to self-censorship. In 2020, India had fallen to rank 142 in the World Press Freedom Index. The Vishwa Guru was outraged. Of course, there's got to be some fraud, jealousy. These Westerners are all jealous. India is overtaking USA and everybody else. So they're all jealous and they're all conspiring. So the government of India, the senior most officer of government of India, the union cabinet secretary, that is the the Badshah of bureaucrats, ordered, you know how important the Union Cabinet Secretary is? Theoretically, he takes his orders only from one man. So the Union Cabinet Secretary ordered the Information Broadcasting Ministry to set up a committee, independent committee, index monitoring cell, to respond to Reporters Sans Frontiers, which runs the World Press Freedom Index. By the way, I'm not obsessed with the world, with Reporters Sans Frontiers and their index either. But when you claim that it's false, why don't you create your own index and see? Now, I'm not impressed with Reporters Sans Frontiers, their performance on index on Gaza and Palestine. I'm not impressed at all what they've done. But the fact is that they put India at that stage at 142. So a big committee was formed, 13-member committee, full of very powerful people. Yours truly was one of only, it was only bureaucrats. Then some mischievous bureaucrat, well-meaning mischievous bureaucrat, told them, you know what, if it's going to be a committee dealing with press freedom, it might be an idea to have a journalist or two. So someone said, that's a good idea. And they got in touch with two of us. The other one I will not name, but is a very famous TV anchor, and you can easily figure it out. What happened to him? He attended 4 hours or two meetings. Have you guys ever heard of a TV anchor who online remained silent for 5 minutes? He remained silent for 4 hours. He did not say a word in either meeting. The beginning of the third meeting, he got on to apologize to all of us, saying that his duties were onerous and he could not keep up with this. So I was left as the only journalist in the pot. Then the powers got worried about that. Since they'd lost a heavyweight, they brought on two middleweights, neither of whom any one of us in the journalistic circles had ever heard of before, but were obviously from the Sangh Parivar. Anyway, they also kept quiet. In every meeting, I didn't tell them why, but I was intervening and speaking up loudly, clearly in every meeting because this was COVID, right? It was all online. It was on Zoom. The reason I did that because I was recording every word. And anyway, at the end of it, they sent out a draft report. I protested about everything. And these are very experienced bureaucrats. They don't fight with you. Anything I said, he would turn to his secretary and say, Mr. Sainath has made a very important point. It should be noted. He knew and I knew that what was noted, he had done the dance before and so had I. We knew the steps, right? So anything I said, he said, very important point. I said, this methodological thing is wrong. Very important point. And of course, the draft report came. The notable thing about the draft report was that it never contained the word draft. Which meant that they were going to... Now, how did they intend to get it past me? The first line of the acknowledgement is effusive praise for yours truly. Don't ever say no to applause, okay? They thought that I'll read those lines and I'll let the report go. Can you imagine a 45-page report on press freedom that did not use the word dissent, that did not use the word censorship? 19 words I listed. None of these words appeared in the report, but they did. I wrote an independent note, still trying to get it in rather than confront. No response. I sent the note 3 times. High-powered government committee vanished. I sent it 1 more time. The email ID vanished. And this was about press freedom and freedom of expression. So guys, this is how it all works in. The inequality works in. The power works in. The judiciary works in. The executive works in. These were the 5. Now, the counter to this is, I can give 3 examples, inspiring ones. One, the small level fight back by independent journalists and independent media. I won't exaggerate our power, and they can squash us at any time they choose. They'll screw us up in many different ways, as they screw me up in many different ways, by scaring donors away from my website. Just before COVID and during COVID, two great things happened. In 2019, tens of thousands of young teenaged kids often collected outside the gates of their hundreds of colleges and read out the preamble of the Indian Constitution while opposing this CA, the Citizenship Act amendment. It was so pleasing. It was so lovely to see teenage kids, some of them my students, I'm very proud to say, all of them reading out the preamble of the Indian Constitution, justice for all, social, economic, political. I went very often to see and I would spot my students. And of course, I would tell them, that's lovely, you're reading the preamble. There's a little more stuff in the Constitution that's also interesting. And if you read, which may not be on WhatsApp, you know, maybe you take a look at the Constitution. But anyway, to give them credit, they did something that brought tears to my eyes. It was a signal, for me, that was a continuation of the spirit of the freedom struggle.
Dr. Sai.
You were just listening to P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style. He spoke in Surrey, British Columbia in early October. P. Sainath is an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style, and for Arundhati Roy's latest book on India, The Architecture of Modern Empire, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Harinder Mahil. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar virtuoso Sharmista Sen performing Raga Kedara.
It has been 37 days since Donald Trump took office, and a lot has been going on every single one of those 37 days. Yeah, and you could be feeling a lot of things about that, but more than anything, you might be feeling overwhelmed, but whatever you're feeling, I want you to know that you should never feel alone. So for the first 100 days, I'm going to be coming to you once a month with a general recap of how Americans are feeling, with polls and data provided by Navigator Research. So these posts will also be nonpartisan. I'm just gonna give you a lay of the land. I always think it's important for you to be able to inform your own opinions and make your own judgment calls. And what better way to do that than discussing the relevant data? So without further ado, let's get into it. Need my notes. So as we know, it is tax season. Yeah, and we've heard a lot of things, whether it's about Donald Trump trying to get rid of the IRS and create an ERS, whatever that means. But more than anything, what we've heard from the White House's messaging that we'll provide more tax cuts to the rich and create cuts to programs that our taxes would typically fund that would benefit the middle and lower classes. Here's what Americans are saying. Trump's alignment with tech CEOs is concerning. Most people, 90%, want tax cuts for the middle class instead. 69% of Americans believe tech CEOs are influencing Trump's administration. And it's seen across all racial groups, 68% in white folks, 66% black, 76% Hispanic, AAPI 77%. So it's not even that. 41% of Americans think Trump will help his billionaire friends get richer instead of helping the middle class. And 80% of Americans say CEOs, billionaires, and foreign investors should not get tax cuts. And speaking of his allegiance to tech billionaires, Elon Musk, his numbers are also dipping as far as favorability. As I'm sure you know, once Trump was put in office, he gave Elon Musk a new department, a Department of General Efficiency, to which he was able to access Americans' private information, our Social Security, the Department of Education, Department of Treasury, and since has laid off several federal employees, and a number of federal programs, once again, have been taking funding cuts. And while he might have landed at a 47% in unfavorability in October of 2024, he's now at 53%, and that might not seem like a big jump, but generally Americans do not want tech billionaires calling shots and meddling in policy, period. Now, with all that said, basically Americans are feeling that Trump is focused on himself, doing what's best for himself. 53% of Americans feel that way. A lot of Americans feel like he's just bringing corruption to D.C., that whole the January 6th pardon. 48% of Americans do not like that or feel negatively about that. 44% of Americans feel negatively about the funding freeze. My biggest takeaway from all these numbers is that even though the election results would lead one to believe that the majority of Americans feel one way, as time passes for sure, discontent is brewing across Americans, regardless of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status, or any walk of life. So, yeah, we'll check back in next month. And if you feel like these numbers were helpful, please visit Navigator's Instagram and their website to see what poll information they have available to you now. Thank you.
You're not acting grateful enough. You're not being thankful. Donald Trump to the leader of Ukraine. Joining our ongoing coverage, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, former National Security Advisor to President Obama, Ambassador Susan Rice is here. Ambassador, your reaction.
Well, Nicole, obviously it's a very sad day and an embarrassment for the United States on the world stage. But let's step back and analyze what's happened here. I think there's no question that this was a setup. You heard Donald Trump say at the end of that clip you played, this is great television. This was a setup. Volodymyr Zelensky was compelled to agree to a horrible deal that would have sent Ukraine's minerals to the United States without any concrete security guarantees. And yet, because he was trying to improve a relationship with Donald Trump, he came to Washington, he came to the Oval Office, and sat down for a meeting, hat in hand. And soon after he got there, the vice president of the United States lit into him and started a confrontation. Now, I've been in countless Oval Office meetings with heads of state, presidents and vice presidents, as national security advisor, as UN ambassador, and in other roles. I can tell you that the vice president or the secretary of state or anybody else, they don't jump in, hijack a conversation without the express blessing of the president of the United States. So J.D. Vance did that deliberately. Donald Trump knew what he was going to do. And I think, as he said at the end, because he can't, you know, help himself, this was a setup for the cameras. It was a play to his base. But above all, it was a play to Vladimir Putin, to show fealty to Vladimir Putin, and to try to humiliate Zelensky. But Zelensky didn't play along with the script, because Zelensky's got dignity and guts, and Zelensky has people that he democratically represents. And as a result, he couldn't sit there in silence as lies were being told about how the war was started, whose responsibility it was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he tried to explain what is in fact the case. To suggest that he was not thankful, I can't count the number of times that Zelensky has thanked the American people, the American government, the President of the United States for the critical support that we've provided. It's not about gratitude. It was an effort to humiliate him, to scuttle the U.S.-Ukraine relationship so that Trump no longer feels any obligation to provide support and to hand U.S. interests and Ukraine and potentially Europe to Putin on a silver platter.
Why?
That's a great question.
Susan, we're gonna unfreeze you. I want to play some more of the president in the Oval Office if we have more of that. We're trying to Ambassador, you're unfrozen.
I hope so.
I say why, and I'll add this. Trump had so much to say about everything he and Putin had been through together. It was like a dictator's version of We Can Do Hard Things, if you're familiar with that podcast. It was insane.
Yeah, Nicole, I think we have to understand that what happened today is really a piece of a larger puzzle. We've seen this building, frankly, since before Trump returned to office. But literally so much of what he has done in his first 5 weeks in office have been to the benefit of Russia and China. So let's review the bidding. You know, threatening our ally, Denmark and Greenland. You know, starting a trade war with our closest allies and partners. Trying to, create a conflict with Canada and trying to pretend to relegate it to the 51st state. Vance going to Munich and basically trying to blow up the NATO alliance. Pulling the United States Agency for International Development 100% off the map and retreating. Proposing to cut 8% a year from the Department of Defense and literally dismantling the federal government and eviscerating it. That is not in any way, shape, or form in the national security interests of the United States. We are not only alone and alienated from our closest allies in Europe and Asia, as we heard from Turnbull, but worse, we have aligned ourselves completely with Russia, who is aligned with China, North Korea, and Iran. So in 5 weeks, we flipped the script, and we are dangerously isolated and cast our lot with adversaries who truly do not have our interests at heart.
I mean, Andrew Nastios, who was the head of USAID for George W. Bush, was on the program and made the argument that USAID keeps us safe from... It kept us safe from another 9/11 in the years after 9/11 because by stemming catastrophe and human suffering, you also counter extremism in some of the most brutal and hostile corners of the globe. That aid isn't just philanthropic, which seems to be Donald Trump's misunderstanding of it, that aid is one of our most mighty soft power tools, not just for ending human suffering, but for keeping us safe here. Another person described this as the worst 24 hours in modern American history, that we dismantle programs to spare children from dying of malaria and measles, mumps, preventable deaths and diseases, and we dismantle the World Alliance. What is Trump's end game if you're an adversary or an ally looking at everything he's doing?
I think his end game is to undermine the security and stability of the United States. And that brings us back to the question that you asked earlier. Why? There's no other way to look at this in sum, Nicole, than to see that this is a deliberate and comprehensive weakening of the United States in very short order, from a security point of view, from an economic point of view, from a diplomatic point of view, all to the benefit of our principal adversaries, Russia primarily, and China. And so I think the sooner the American people understand what this is about, what's at stake, the clearer we can be. Now, Vladimir Putin is not popular in the United States. 80% of Americans understand him to be the vicious, cruel dictator that he is. But I'd love to hear more than one Republican in Congress stand up and say, that this is not who the United States is. This is not what we signed up for. And more importantly, this is not making America safer. It's, in fact, making us weaker and shrinking in the world. And it is going to make every American less safe.
I mean, before the Oval Office ambush, Republicans were on the record as recently as last week criticizing Putin, calling him what he is, and praising Zelensky. At least one Republican senator, I think it's Mr. Wicker, deleted a tweet today and got in line with almost the same. This is Senator Wicker deleted a tweet highlighting the meeting with Zelensky and the bipartisan group of senators this morning, which he said went swimmingly. It went great. Zelensky was impressive and courageous and brave. And Democrats and Republicans left that meeting with high praise for Zelensky. He deleted this tweet praising Zelensky after Trump and Vance berated him in what you describe as a setup. What does that send to the world, that message?
Well, it's tragic. Senator Wicker knows better. So do many of the senators on both sides of the aisle that participated in that meeting earlier.
There's that tweet up on the screen again. This was from this morning's. Republican Senator Wicker tweeted, "Today, several U.S. senators had the opportunity to meet with President Zelensky to discuss Ukraine's future and the mineral deal brokered by President Trump. This is a huge step forward in securing mutual prosperity and peace for Americans and Ukrainians." Senator Wicker tweeted that and then deleted it, Susan Rice.
And deleted it knowing better, as do so many of his Republican colleagues, as well as Democrats. And they are just kowtowing to a leader out of fear and cowardice and selling out the national interest in the process. For all this talk we've heard for decades about how strong and muscular Republicans are on national security and defense, how they stand for freedom, as Ronald Reagan did, and up for democracy, they have just folded. And they are complicit in the undermining of our national security and our national interests.
What are your worries about what happens now? Now that Putin and Vance have done this, we're at the hinge point, right? It will forever be for Ukraine what happened before that meeting and what happens after. What is the risk now for the Ukrainian people?
Well, I worry about the Ukrainian people. I worry about Europe, and I worry about the wider world. For the Ukrainian people, they have no choice but to continue to do all that they can to defend themselves. They are facing an extremely powerful and hostile aggressor who now twice has invaded their country, and they're right to believe he'll do it again if given the opportunity. So they're going to have no choice except to continue to defend themselves. And one can hope that there might be some path to patching things up, but I think that's very hard to envision. I don't think Donald Trump wants that. I think he wants the outcome he got today. And that means that Europe and our other Democratic allies or erstwhile allies will need to do as much as they possibly can to continue to support Ukraine. People don't recall that Europe already has provided more billions more in assistance to Ukraine than the United States has, economic and military. They're going to need to continue to carry the load while the United States casts its lot with Vladimir Putin.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades, Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruisin' the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
This is where the magic happens. Musical history, recorded sound, and the miracle of radio broadcasting. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades, episode number 151, cruisinthedecades.com. And on today's show, remembering Mick Ralphs and Lou Christie, plus a well-beloved song of the musical My Fair Lady. In 1985, on the big screen and in Motown with producer Rick James. And a song unlike anything else in the psychedelic late 60s, a song I only recently discovered with a little help from our close personal friends, the Black Keys. It's Cruisin' the Decades, one song per decade. We'll begin in 1912 with a very delightful love song by two of the biggest pop singers of the teens and 20s, Ada Jones and Billy Murray, together. This is so delightful. It's called Be My Little Bumblebee on Cruisin' the Decades.
Funny little honeybee.
Billy Bumble used to mumble round the rosemary.
Where she would meet him, greet him, and then treat him to some honey squeeze.
Then start a buzzing in a dozen different loving keys. Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
Bring home all the honey love to me.
Little bee, little bee, little bee.
Let me spend the happy hours roving with you amongst the flowers. And when we get where no one else can see.
Cuddle up, cuddle up, cuddle up.
Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
We'll be just as happy as can be.
You and me, you and me, you and me.
Honey, keep a buzzing, please. I've got a dozen cousin bees.
But I want you to be my baby bumblebee. Call on her mama and her papa bee.
Papa bee said, goodness me, and mama said, we'll see.
If you can pay your way for every day, the price of honey grows dear.
But little Queenie said that for Sweeney and whispered in his ear. Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
Bring home all the honey love to me.
Little bee, little bee, little bee.
Let me spend the happy hours roving with you amongst the flowers. And when we get where no one else can see.
Cuddle up, cuddle up, cuddle up.
Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
We'll be just as happy as can be.
You and me, you and me, you and me.
Honey, keep a buzzing, please. I've got a dozen cousin bees.
But I want you to be my baby bumblebee.
You can hear the improvements in recording technology and the evolution of through the decades and beyond. Over 100 years of music. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades. Broadcast worldwide on AM, FM, and shortwave.
Thank you.
Cruisin' the Decades with 100 years of music and music history appreciation. That's quite a remarkable selection right there. That's from guitarist Sylvester Weaver. It's called Guitar Rag. Beautiful instrumental from 1923. Cruising the decades, moving into the 1930s with a great large band, Andy Kirk and his 12 Clouds of Joy. And he was one of just a handful of black band leaders in the big band era. This is called Until the Real Thing Comes Along on Cruising the Decades, 1936.
I would work for you, I'd slave for you, I'd be a beggar or a knave for you. If that ain't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along, I'd gladly move the earth for you, to prove my love, dear, and its worth for you. If that ain't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along, with all the words, dear, at my command, I just can't make you understand. I'll always love you, darling, come what may. My heart is yours, what more can I say? I beg for you, I'd lie for you, I'd draw the stars down from the sky for you. If that ain't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along. I would rob, steal, beg, borrow, and I'd lie for you. I'd draw the stars down from the sky for you. If that ain't love, it'll have to do. Until the real thing comes along.
An audio journey, song by song, through every genre of popular music and recorded music history, from swing, jazz, folk, and blues, and the Great American Songbook, to punk, new wave, garage, and alternative. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. 100 years of music, one song per decade.
Sugar is so refined, she's one of them high class kind. She doesn't wear a hat, she wears a chapeau. She goes to see a cinema but never a show. My sugar is so refined, she's got a real high class mind. She never buys a dress, it's always a frock. She always winds her timepiece up, but never her clock.
She says tomato instead of tomato. She says potato instead of potato.
And you should see how she holds a cup of tea with just two fingers while she sticks out three.
My sugar is so refined. She's one of them high-class kind.
She never shares a kiss. She lets our lips unite. But oh, it feels like kissing. Each kiss is dynamite. I wonder what she thinks of each time I hold her tight. Oh, she's so refined.
My sugar is real refined. Got the finest kind of mind. She never eats a meal, she dines or sups. And dogs are little canine friends, they're never pups.
She says banana instead of banana. She says piano instead of piano. And you should see how she sits on her settee.
Cake and coffee balanced on one knee.
My sugar is so refined.
She's one of them high-class kind.
She acts just like her name is Mrs. Vanderloon.
And though I love her and we'll be married soon,
I wonder what she'll do when we're on our honeymoon.
Oh, she's so refined. She's so refined.
It's Cruisin' the Decades with Johnny Mercer and the Pied Pipers, a real music biz giant, a performer and singer and bandleader, yes, and also a notable songwriter of many famous songs that live on very, very well to today and will live forever in the pop music vernacular. Plus, he was also a co-founder of Capitol Records, so a big music industry executive. And we'll move into the 1950s with a very, very beloved song of the musical My Fair Lady. This is the 1956 soundtrack version, Vic Damone, along with Percy Faith and his orchestra and chorus, On the Street Where You Live. Perhaps the most famous version of this magnificent song from music's glorious past. It's Cruisin' the Decades.
Just to know somehow you are near. I have often walked on this street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I enchantment pour out of every door. No, it's just on the street where you live. Oh, the towering feeling just to know. Suddenly appear.